Abnormal pauses in breathing during sleep may be a symptom of a common disorder called sleep apnea. This hour, a Des Moines mother will tell us about her son, whose death may have been related to sleep apnea. This is River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Neurologist Dr. Eric Dykin joins us as well this hour for our regular update on sleep news and research. Dykin is director of the Sleep Disorders Center at the University of Iowa Hospitals and Clinics. He'll tell us about the latest science on sleep apnea, as well as the warning signs and treatments that are available. Also, SAD, seasonal affective disorder, a problem for some during these short winter days, and your questions and experiences. It's all about the science of sleep this hour after this news. This is River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Today, one of our periodic updates on the latest science and news having to do with a state in which we spend roughly a third of our lives and know relatively little about. Of course, I'm talking about sleep. I want to welcome our listeners to join us with telling us what keeps you awake at night. Share your sleep problem, your question. This hour, 1-866-780-9100, river to river at iowapublicradio.org. Initially, we want to focus on a sleep disorder called sleep apnea, one of the most common sleep disorders. And of course, our guest during our sleep disorder shows, neurologist Dr. Eric Dykin, director of the Sleep Disorders Center at the University of Iowa Hospitals and Clinics. He's once again in our Iowa City studio. Welcome, Dr. Dykin.
Thanks for having me.
We also want to welcome, in the first part of our show, Kate Carter-Frederick is joining us by phone from Des Moines, where she lives. Listeners may remember a conversation, Kate, that we had with you recently when we invited you to tell us about a person who had changed your life. Kate, welcome to our program.
Thank you very much.
You told us a few days ago about your son, Joseph, a remarkable young man. You shared his life with us. Helped so many as a paramedic in Johnson County for several years. The inspiration you talked about, you found in the way he lived his relatively short life. He died in 2011 at the age of 25, and we've asked you to be on our regular sleep show to talk about something we didn't talk about a few days ago. That was Joseph's apparent problem with sleep apnea. And Kate, I want to thank you for joining us, especially at a time when your family is still in grieving. And once again, our condolences for the loss of your son. Thank you, Kate.
Oh, thank you, Ben.
I wonder if you can start off. We want to learn a little bit about Joseph's sleep disorder, and I want to invite Dr. Dykin, of course, to jump in with any questions you would like to, Doctor, as we're talking with Kate about her son. Can you start off, Kate, by describing the type of sleep problems your son experienced toward the end of his life?
Oh, sure. We lived with this on a daily basis when Joseph would try to sleep, but he really struggled to find sleep. If he did settle in to sleep, he would stop breathing, and then after some seconds, he would choke and cough or gasp and cough. Sometimes there was just an absolutely horrible gurgling sound. He would wake up repeatedly and really struggle to get back to sleep. And more often than not, he would wake up exhausted as if he hadn't slept at all.
Mm-hmm. What kind of help did he seek for this?
Well, at first he was reluctant because he was a paramedic and he really didn't want anyone to think of him as anything less than able, I think. He did finally go to a doctor after much pleading and cajoling, and his doctor thought that he would be a great candidate for surgery that's done now to open the airway. There's some tissue that can be removed to help people breathe better when they sleep. And I needed to help Joseph by making a sleep tape, you know, recording him while he was sleeping. And we were in the process of doing that when he left this life.
Mm. Dr. Dykin, this certainly sounds like sleep apnea, doesn't it?
Yeah, and as she's so eloquently presented the big three problems that you can concisely describe as insomnia, trying to find sleep, difficulty waking repeatedly, waking exhausted with the subsequent sleepiness is the other big thing, and then the choking, the coughing, the gurgling, snoring is another way you might define that, but how do you define it? But difficulty with breathing during sleep, the insomnia and the sleepiness are the classic big three that she describes so well.
Mm-hmm. How did this affect his health otherwise, Kate? You know, feeling like you didn't sleep, of course, is a big drag on the day, on whether you're a paramedic or whatever work you're doing. But, you know, we know first responders don't have an easy time of sleep as it is because they have such mixed up schedules and have to respond so quickly.
Oh, that's so right. He was working as hard as possible to be a responsible young adult, going to college full-time and working as a paramedic, which, you know, both of those things are stressful, and he was just continually exhausted. And I think the additional aspect is that as a first responder, he was repeatedly traumatized by what he saw and experienced, and sometimes the first responders don't get the help that they need to process these experiences.
Mm-hmm.
I've read that can affect their sleep apnea, too.
Mm-hmm. So we have some many factors. The stress, a highly stressful job here, Dr. Daikin, contributing to what is something that is perhaps biologically wrong with the throat, the breathing apparatus in Joseph.
Again, as she describes so eloquently, if you have trauma, if you're a first responder, if you see a horrible, horrific house fire, injuries, what do most people do after seeing these terrific things? Well, they often have difficulty sleeping. They're catecholamines. They're get up and go. They're autonomic. Their sympathetic nervous systems are wired to keep awake. And it's just another nail that she implies that affects the quality of the sleep.
After hearing this story, Dr. Daikin, and I understand that sleep apnea is very difficult to describe as a cause of death here. Or is it, Dr. Daikin?
Well, there's been one publication describing what we believe is a cause and effect, death from sleep apnea, and we published this a few years ago in an expedited publication in the Green Journal of Neurology. How do you watch something like that ethically, and how do you address cause and effect? Because it's the low oxygen, the effect on the heart and the brain that actually affects one thing that affects another thing. And as we've implied, people with sleep apnea often have other things going on with their health. And what exactly it is that combines to cause a person's death from sleep apnea, it can be the blood pressure, too high, too low, the lack of oxygen to the brain or the heart having a problem with the rhythm and maybe even stopping. And as such, cause and effect is difficult to determine. But one thing is for sure, we all need air to keep alive. And this is the problem with apnea. You get very little air. And to be at least a contribution, well, again, I think it's definitely contributing to a lot of health-related problems.
Kate Carter-Frederick, you said that your son was reluctant to seek help here too. You undoubtedly tried many times to get him to get some more help here as well. What was his thinking? Describe a little bit more about that reluctance.
Well, I think maybe it had as much to do with his age as anything, Ben. He, as a young adult, was very intent on becoming an adult, becoming fully responsible for himself, and he was at that age where he didn't really want his mother telling him what to do. He was also, in his character, he was pretty stubborn, and he preferred to do things his way and his time. He was really in the process of building his confidence as a person while he was building his career too, and I think he just really wanted to do it his way. And part of me also thinks that there was that element of fear involved where it's a very uncomfortable thing to think that you might have a condition that can really limit your life or limit your lifespan, and it's just sort of hard to face.
Mm-hmm.
One other thing was that Joseph smoked, and that may have contributed to it too, and having been a smoker many decades ago, it's one of those things that you don't want other people telling you that you can't smoke anymore.
Mm-hmm. If you just joined us, we're having our regular sleep news and research program with Dr. Eric Dyke, and director of the Sleep Disorders Center at the University of Iowa Hospitals and Clinics. Kate Carter-Frederick of Des Moines is good enough to join us this first half hour. Her son, Joseph, passed away in 2011 at the age of 25, discussing his sleep apnea problems. And I wonder here, Dr. Dyke, and you have seen probably thousands of patients in your sleep center being diagnosed, looked at for sleep disorders. There is a reluctance in a vast majority of patients, would it be a majority, to be diagnosed, to look at a sleep disorder. A lot of them, I guess what I'm saying is a lot of them go undiagnosed, don't they?
A lot of them, maybe most of them, go undiagnosed. And again, not breathing when you go to sleep has been associated with a multitude of different health-related problems, abnormal heart rhythms, low oxygen to the brain, stroke, heart attacks, atrial fibrillation. There's a lot of bad things that low oxygen to the body does. But for any of us, healthcare is expensive. It's an economic problem throughout the world. That's fear in itself. Money's hard to come by. And when you're a young person starting out on your own and you may have something that entails seeing the doctor for any kind of procedure, it's expensive. I went through two sleep studies myself last year. My copay was pretty hefty through the sleep laboratory, but I knew what the end result would be. But even with that, I didn't want to have apnea. I didn't want to get older. I didn't want to be mortal. And there's a lot of other cases, not just apnea, but breast cancer, prostatic carcinoma, hypertension, heart disease, just aging. We'd rather not see that. It's scary. And if you deny and you can continue on without the help of a doctor, well, that's one element. And then the expense of a doctor. There's a lot of different things.
So what can someone do, Dr. Dyken, who is listening, who needs some encouragement themselves or perhaps is thinking of a loved one who is experiencing some symptoms here of abnormal breathing during sleep, and there is that reluctance to go see the doctor and talk about it. What do you find the most effective way to get that person to the doctor?
Oh, listening to people like Kate. And when it hurts you and yours, we've had other friends on this show who have had loved ones who have been affected adversely. When they come up and witness, when it's a friend, when it's a relative, when it's a non-physician, a non-nurse, a non-healthcare professional, and you can put it in common sense terminology, that's when you know that you and me can have it too. You and me can go see a doctor, a nurse, a healthcare professional, have it taken care of relatively pleasantly, effortlessly, and make you feel better.
Mm-hmm. Kate, and of course, that's I understand that's one of your motivations for coming forward, even though you're still grieving. You and your family are still grieving. Spread the word about this, right?
Oh, yes. And, you know, Joseph loved the idea that he was helping people. He thrived on that, and he would want to be helping people now. He would want people to learn from his experience. And for my part, if I can help any one person from the heartbreak that we live with now, it's all worthwhile.
Mm-hmm. When we talked earlier, Kate, by phone, you had a very poignant poem by Emily Dickinson that is a favorite that you connect with this. Can you tell us or perhaps even recite that? I don't know.
Well, this kept coming to mind when we did talk about this program, Ben, and it really helped motivate me to chat with you guys today, and it is, if I can stop one heart from breaking, I shall not live in vain. If I can ease one life the aching, or cool one pain, or help one fainting robin unto his nest again, I shall not live in vain.
That's a beautiful poem, and certainly from what you've told us, the way that Joseph lived his life.
And it's exactly the point. There was one Joseph. There are thousands of people listening to this now, and I know as a matter of fact, there will be more lives saved because of Joseph's loss. Joseph did not live in vain. No, he gave something back, and there will be people alive 10 years from now because of what you've done today. This is what opens people's eyes, not necessarily long white coat physicians.
Kate Carter Frederick, we're going to say goodbye and thank you so much for helping us understand the Joseph's case and coming forward. I know it's a very difficult time for you. Kate, thank you so much.
Oh, thank you too. And Dr. Dyke, and I sure wish that Joseph and I could have met you 2 or 3 years ago.
Well, you both be meet me in 10, 50, 100 years. We'll all be in the same place. That's what I believe in. I really appreciate what you've done for everyone.
Well, I will look forward to that day, and I'm so grateful for this one and to both of you. Thank you very, very much.
Thank you.
Thank you. Bye now, Kate.
Bye-bye.
Let's finish up with a few questions about sleep apnea and also invite our listeners, Dr. Dyken, to join our conversation, whether it's a question about sleep apnea or some other sleep problem or question that you have. 1-866-780-9100. Dr. Dyken with us through the end of the hour. 1-866-780-9100. River to River at iowapublicradio.org. Iowa Public Radio is also on Facebook or on Twitter to tweet us at IPR Talk. How is sleep apnea diagnosed, Dr. Dyken?
Well, you know, and she did a great diagnosis. When you have this combination of horrifically loud snoring, repeated arousals with gasping for breath, insomnia throughout the night, and despite the fact sleeping hours and hours and hours or attempting to, as she said, trying to, pathologically exhausted, sleepy, those big three, the horrific snoring, the insomnia, the daytime sleepiness despite enough sleep are often the big three complaints that we hear about. If you add on other health-related problems, obesity, big tonsils in children, hypertension, cardiac disease, and maybe even stroke, those things sort of add to the formula.
Mm-hmm. So this is – sleep apnea is something just because maybe you have a 15-year-old at home. It could affect a young person as well?
We're having an obesity explosion in the United States. You know, it's a double-edged sword. Actually, some of the greatest times we're having now despite all the economic and this and that. And my wife is a pediatric sleep expert, and we see children all the time. It's obesity explosion where you gain weight a little bit in your stomach, your hips, et cetera. You can gain it in the back of your throat. Simple way of looking at it, of course. That, add a couple of tonsils. It gets heavy and relaxed in the middle of the night, and it closes off, and you have apnea even in children.
I wonder, once sleep apnea is diagnosed, what sort of treatments are available?
Well, you know, I had had the apnea. I lost a whole bunch of weight, 55 pounds, and praise the Lord, if I slept on my stomach, and we've talked about position, that's a positional therapy. Gravity pulled my airways open. Then as the years went by, I woke up one day with visual loss in my right eye, and my weight was back up, and I went back to the lab. My apnea was worse, and I went on, now that I was failing my positional therapy, my weight loss therapy, I went back on the CPAP therapy, which was much better than it was 10 years ago. And my son will now go on vacation with me because he doesn't have to hear the horrific snoring. Swear to God, I've tripped over him in the bathroom at Disneyland. So what are you doing on the floor? He goes, Dad, I can't stand the snoring. So it's taking care of a couple problems, I think.
Mm-hmm. John is joining us from Cedar Falls. Hi, John. You have an experience with sleep apnea or something else?
Yes, I do. As a matter of fact, I believe it's been about 10 years ago, I actually went through the sleep clinic with our good doctor, and it was prescribed to me that I needed a CPAP machine at the time. I had over several hundred interruptions of my sleep over the course of my sleeping pattern, and now that I've gotten older and I'm trying to be in less denial and follow up on a New Year's resolution, I decided I wanted to do something about it. But I always thought it was rather unsexy, if you will, to sleep with a CPAP machine on in bed. And I'd heard about some clinic that offered a surgery to your throat that might alleviate the snoring, but I don't know if it also alleviates the apnea. I'm assuming it would, but I'd like to know more about that procedure rather than the alternative to wearing a CPAP machine.
Okay, John, thank you for that call. To make sure all of our listeners are on board, a CPAP machine does what, doctor?
Yeah, it's a continuous positive airway pressure. CPAP is what it stands for, and it's a small mask that is placed over the nose or over the nose and mouth, delivers a gentle column of air, acts as a stent to keep the airways open all the way from the nose to the lungs, and that's what I use. And it's a lot better than it used to be, and I think my machine's sexy. So anyway, there's no question there's a mindset that you said it, resolution. But the surgeries generally are about 15 to 40% at the best with correcting the sleep apnea, because sleep apnea can be due to a variety of reasons. And in some respects, the surgeons just can't get to all the tissue or predict all the tissue they would need to take out. I think in the future, we're going to have better and better surgeries. But right now, they're very, very good for snoring. The uvulopalatopharyngoplasty, and that's all Latin terms for the stuff in the back of your throat. The uvula, the thing hangs down the back of your throat, far side, you get 50 points, you get it right on the test, whatever. They just cut out the stuff that's flopping around. Very good. And the treatment of choice for snoring, but again, insurance companies think that's cosmetic. I think they're wrong in that regard, but it's very, very good for the snoring, but does not always get the sleep apnea.
Okay, John in Cedar Falls, we wish you a good sleep, and let's move on to Nancy in Vinton. Your question, Nancy.
My son uses a CPAP machine, and he is 42 years old, and he's Down syndrome, and he is not keeping it on at night. It was suggested by his psychiatrist that he use a BiPAP. I would like to know the difference between the BiPAP and the CPAP and what you would recommend.
Nancy, thank you very much. Doctor, we have about a minute before a break. Go ahead.
Yeah, the CPAP is continuous pressure. And so when you breathe back out, you're breathing out against a small hurricane relative. The BiPAP, if you fail CPAP, and that's one thing the insurance people have to show, that you just cannot tolerate it, then you can go to the more expensive BiPAP machine that has a little computer chip that senses when you inspire. You're breathing with the flow. It gives you higher pressure on inspiration. Physiologically, that's what you need. Just trust me on that one. And when you breathe out, you usually need a lesser pressure, and it will sense that, and it will lower the pressure that you breathe out against, make it more comfortable. But sometimes for Down syndrome, and my wife runs a Down syndrome sleep apnea clinic. She's done a lot of research on that. Sometimes making the condition a little bit more positive conditioning can help, well, even people without Down syndrome. That attitude we allude to.
Okay, Nancy and Vinton, does that do it for you?
Well, yes, but we've just tried everything, and he's only keeping it on about an hour a night, and that is not doing it. Mm-hmm. And so I wondered if it would be worth trying the BiPAP.
Okay. Maybe so. And then you might want to stop by and get into my wife's clinic. Not to belittle the local doctor, they are the backbone of medicine. But she does have an extra specialty, especially with the Down syndrome population, with a lot of assistance that they might be able to offer.
Nancy in Vinton, thank you very much for your call. We wish you good luck there with your son. And we're coming back in just a moment. What keeps you awake at night? Share your sleep problem or question. Dr. Eric Dykin, neurologist, director of the Sleep Disorders Clinic at the University of Iowa Hospitals and Clinics, will be back in just a few more minutes. This is River to River.
I need some sleep. It can't go on like this. I tried counting sheep, but there's one I...
And we're back with more of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Forget about riverboats. Online gaming is the new frontier when it comes to gambling in Iowa. Tomorrow on this program, we'll discuss the future of gambling in Iowa, how the evolving regulation of online gaming may help or hinder the state's gaming industry. We talked with a University of Iowa researcher as well who has a new study suggesting that more casinos does not necessarily create more gamblers. Find out about that tomorrow during the hour today. It is, well, fluff up your pillows today and tonight, I guess we can say, National Sleep Day. I don't know who determines that. Dr. Dykin is with us, neurologist, director of the Sleep Disorders Center at the University of Iowa Hospitals and Clinics. Do you get to pick the day for National Sleep Day?
Thank goodness I don't have that responsibility.
We're celebrating by brushing up on the latest in sleep news and research, talking mainly about sleep apnea this hour. But any of your questions, sleep-related problems you want to ask about, feel free to do that. 1-866-780-9100, river-to-river at iowapublicradio.org. If you prefer email, we're also on Facebook, or you can tweet us at IPR Talk. Doctor, if it's okay with you, we'll go right back to the phones. Drew is joining us from Des Moines. Hi, Drew. Thanks for waiting.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Go ahead.
I guess my sleep apnea story started in high school. Grades suffered, had issues with depression. No one knew why. I was never sleeping. It was just kind of terrible. And then my freshman year at the University of Northern Iowa, I was 20 years old or 19 years old, and it was suggested to me I should get a sleep test. And lo and behold, I had sleep apnea. And no one in my family had ever been diagnosed with it. I wasn't overweight. My tonsils had been removed at age 2. So I was always just kind of curious how I came upon this when no one in my family did. I mean, is there genetics involved or anything like that?
Yeah, I would think to some degree, because it's sort of a circuitous thing. I mean, you have to go to sleep to have it, so there's a physiologic element, a demand of sleep, so it gets all fancy there. But it often comes down to the anatomy that relaxes the back of your throat. And some of us have a little tighter throats. I have a bit of a tighter throat, and we call it a Malam Potty score, named it after some sleep doctor from way back when. So when the doctor looks in the back of your mouth and you just sort of open your jaw and stick your tongue out, if they can't see the base of the uvula, the thing that's hanging down in the back of your throat, we talked about that before, well, then you're a Malam Potty 4. So you just might have a tight throat. And generally, you tend to inherit, you know, the size of your feet, your hands, your jaw. You know, you sort of look like your parents. So in that regard, there's probably a bit of a genetic sense. And I'll bet you money that everybody in your family hasn't had a sleep study. And we've already implied that most of us don't want to volunteer to go into a sleep lab and be diagnosed. I mean, there's a natural hesitance. And if the signs and symptoms aren't there, I wouldn't go to the sleep lab either. But yeah, I think there's probably some genetics involved.
Drew, how have you been coping with your sleep apnea these days?
Oh, after that, I'm 27 now. After I started my CPAP therapy, and I have had the throat surgery, so now I don't have a uvula. It's fantastic. It's changed my life. I made dean's list every year after that at Northern Iowa.
Yeah, great for you.
You mean you can actually think during the day?
Yeah, it's not just walking around in a cloud in a haze.
Yeah, so there's some results from the therapy. There you go.
Drew in Des Moines, thanks for sharing your story.
Thank you.
Okay, 1-866-780-9100. As far as treatments, Dr. Dykin, we mentioned the CPAP machine, the BiPAP machine, surgery. A couple of other things that I know people are aware of that they may be wondering about. There is help for snoring, perhaps apnea, a mouthpiece that you can buy, or also nasal strips.
And there's also, mouthpieces and oral devices. In fact, Dr. Snyder here at the university is our dentist, who's an expert on the oral devices. And he sees 100 or more patients a year who have a relatively mild to moderate apnea, and they're often a candidate because it changes the position of the throat, a simple way of looking at it. But there are different devices, and he has a specific device that he likes. And there's a lot of things out there, though, that you've mentioned, nasal devices, oral devices. But some of the experts that often tend to be dentists, they often like their favorites that have good running track records.
Mm-hmm. Okay, let's go to Carl in Iowa City. Welcome to our regular sleep show with Dr. Eric Dykin. Carl, what's on your mind?
Oh, I just want to call in and advocate the use of the CPAP for anybody out there who is questioning whether or not they should have a study done or do it. In my experience, I was diagnosed with sleep apnea back in 95, and I've been using a CPAP ever since. Totally changed my life. And for me, I guess one of the deciding factors to finally go in and have the study done was that I tended to want to fall asleep at my desk during the day, and then it got worse when during a commute I would have to pull over on the road and just take 10 minutes to nod off so that I could continue driving home.
Really? And that's a commute here in Iowa? Because our commutes generally aren't very long.
Well, I just spent some time driving back and forth between Iowa City and Cedar Rapids on I-380. And,
wow.
You know, all it would take would be 10 or 15 minutes for me behind the wheel of a car on a monotonous stretch of road, and I'd want to nod off. And, you know, not only is that a threat to myself and my family, but to other people on the road as well. And I'm sure every year, you know, we hear of people falling asleep at the wheel behind their car, and who knows, maybe it has to do with apnea. But make a long story short, I use that CPAP every night, and now I'm at a desk all day in front of a computer. I average maybe about 7 hours of sleep a night, and I feel great.
That is a wonderful story. And imagine the length of time you use a CPAP. You've seen generational changes in the advances they've made in that technology.
You know, I really have, and the cost has come down considerably. There's resources available on the Internet to purchase CPAPs and supplies. I just bought a new CPAP machine, about a year and a half ago, and I'm using a lightweight, what they call a nasal pillow, which just goes over your nostrils. It's not a full-blown mask. And I heard one of your other callers call in and say that there's nothing sexy about a CPAP mask when you're sleeping. But, hey, it just makes all the difference in the world. You'll feel sexy, you know, for 18 hours a day. You only need that thing when you're sleeping.
Carl in Iowa City, thanks so much for sharing.
I think my machine's sexy. I don't know.
All right, thanks. Enjoy the program.
Thanks, Carl.
Thanks.
let's go on to Beth in Des Moines. Hi, Beth.
Hello.
I wanted
to share an experience that my late husband had with sleep apnea. And when he was diagnosed, he immediately started using a CPAP, which worked great. And, you know, the previous caller endorsed the CPAP. I would, too. But after a while, we were living a pretty active lifestyle. We liked to camp. We liked to tent camp in places where there weren't electricity. We liked to travel overseas. And so it was kind of a pain to, you know, carry the CPAP around. So one day I was at the dentist and saw a brochure, and in her office for an oral device that, you know, that the doctor had mentioned earlier on the show. And my husband was evaluated for that and turned out that it wasn't going to work for him.
Mm-hmm.
But she recommended that he see an oral surgeon, and which he did. And the oral surgeon said, well, he would be a candidate for jaw surgery. And so first he had to have some orthodontia work done. So at the age of 50, he was in getting braces, and that worked out fine. And then he had surgery to change the position of his jaw, and that solved the problem.
Yeah.
And so we were able to, you know, travel around without the CPAP machine. So, you know, there are other alternatives.
Yeah, absolutely. And, in fact, especially for our children, you don't have to be big and heavy, but there's a lot of patients with croissants, and there's a lot of fancy names for a lot of these syndromes that the young kids can have, and they have small chins, a simple way of looking at it. And if you pull the chin forward, it opens what we call the anterior airway space. This is what most of the oral devices, I think we use a thing called a TAP device. It pulls that jaw forward. So there are surgical procedures out there now. There are oral devices. And for some of the kids, it also makes them look like their brothers and sisters. So it may be expensive. It may be time consumptive, but it's a quality of life issue. And as you've implied, there are a bunch of different alternatives out there for a lot of different people in regard to apnea.
And I guess just one thing I'd like to add, too. This was covered by insurance.
So. Yeah.
Beth,
great. Beth, thank you for sharing. From Des Moines.
You're welcome. 1-866-780-9100.
We want to get to as many callers as possible. Always a very popular hour to talk about sleep. Why shouldn't it be? It determines how we feel when we're not asleep. Stephen is with us in Ames. Stephen, can you hear me?
Yes.
You perhaps have a radio on. Maybe you could turn that down. We'd be a little bit better off.
Yeah. Got it down, yep.
Okay, Steve, what's on your mind?
I'm just calling to say I'm going in on Monday for a sleep study. I've never done it before. Just kind of wondering what to expect.
Good question. Yeah, what would be a... Does it seem kind of big and scary to you, Stephen?
Well, it's just, you know, the thought of sleeping somewhere overnight, you know, being hooked up to all kinds of stuff. From what I'm told, I know I need it. but yeah, just coming up this Monday. So
okay, let's give you a preview if we can, Dr.
Yeah.
Daikin.
Well, it all depends on where you're going to be seen. We're sort of in a hospital setting, and our beds are a little bit harder because we see heavy people, small people. So to fit all comers, the great big beds are a little bit firmer. But most people that we see are so sleepy, they could sleep with a jackhammer going off. A lot of my colleagues have rooms that are as comfortable as hotels. And in fact, some of my colleagues actually have rooms at hotels. They'll rent out whole floors of hotels so that it's hotel comfortable. So they really try to work for that kind of comfort. Usually you're in a private room. They have a television set. There's often a community room where you can go to if you just can't get to sleep because, you know, you are away from home and you have wires all over your head.
How long does it take to hook you up or prepare you for sleep?
Well, I think they give 15 to 30 minutes. My techs are real fast. They all work through that Kirkwood program that has been around since the early 1900s. So they're very, very good. And most of the techs in our state, the Iowa Association of Electrodiagnostic Technologists, they train them good. So they often do a superb job of getting you hooked up. But there are electrodes that read your brainwaves. And that's how we determine your different stages of sleep. There are electrodes that follow your airflow and your heart rate and your movement. So there's a lot of things entailed that might otherwise not be what you're used to. But usually they're expert technicians, expert groups that can help get you to sleep. And the beauty of having bad apnea, if there's anything, is you're often so dead tired, you can sleep through most of that very well. And on occasion, though, some people have a little more difficulty. And then what we do is just extend the study until you do get good sleep so you don't have to worry about getting to bed by a certain hour.
Okay. Stephen, may we ask where you're having your sleep study?
I'm up in Minneapolis. I just happened to be driving through Iowa today, and I heard the program, and I was just fascinated just because this is what I've been kind of researching myself for the last couple weeks.
Well,
and finally got scheduled. So,
good luck with your sleep study, Stephen. I hope you have better sleep in the future.
A lot of hot shots in Minneapolis. A lot of good people
appreciate,
there.
Appreciate your time. Thank you.
Bye now. Let's take a perhaps related but probably not related tweet from Christy listening to our program. Christy writes, I have vivid dreams all night and wake up exhausted like I ran a marathon. That's all we have to go on, Dr. Daikin. What do you think is going on there?
You know, like I say, be real careful when doctors on radio shows who don't do a full history and physical examination, which is the basis of all medicine. You know, I'm not looking under the hood, but if you have horrific dreams, I always say rule out apnea first because apnea is worse when your muscles totally relax. Your muscles are most relaxed, including those in the back of your throat, in REM, rapid eye movement, dreaming, or paralyzed sleep. So when we have people who have horrific dreams and they haven't had a lot of trauma, I often worry that they're having low oxygen. And that's how I had mine diagnosed. I dreamed I was drowning.
Mm-hmm. So what should she do?
I would go talk to her general practitioner. The general doctor is a backbone of medicine in the United States. Tell him the full history, look under the hood, then see what the general practitioner recommends because we're all being trained in sleep medicine nowadays. It's a mandate.
Here's an email from Lori. Lori writes, I have insomnia. Any advice for natural sleep help or alternative? She writes, I have been on generic Ambien for the last several months but have the memory loss type symptoms and cannot sit still till I pass out. Kind of scares me. That would scare me too, Lori.
Yeah, and we call this cognitive behavioral therapy, CBT. And, you know, it seems so simple, but some of these things that are cognitive behavioral are common sense. You make the bedroom an inviting situation. You use the bedroom nothing for sleep or sex. That's what it's for, not doing the bills, a routine bedtime. And we call a lot of the cognitive behavioral therapies the stimulus control, progressive relaxation therapies, cognitive therapies. And oftentimes, it's holistic. It's without medications, but you often need to see a good psychologist, a sleep expert, physicians, nurses who are trained in cognitive behavioral therapies. But Google it. You'll pull up five or six different things that can tell you good sleep hygiene practices, how to arrange your bedroom to make it inviting, and one of the things I do, routine bedtime if I can do it, and a good comic book. And within 15 minutes, I'm always asleep. And this is the way we do it with the Writer's Workshop. In Iowa City, that's inviting to me. But look that up on the internet, and if it doesn't work for you, see your local physician.
Okay, Lori, thank you for that email. And the National Sleep Day today, the Huffington Post came out with a list of things, Doctor, that it says we've learned about sleep since last year's National Sleep Day in only a year. And this is an area, you can remind us, this is an area of science and research that is really blossoming. Mm-hmm. There's a great need for it, and there's a great area of unknowns out there, isn't there?
Absolutely. And it's not as though we haven't looked at dreams and sleep. 3000 BC, the Chinese were looking at nightmares and night terrors and sleep paralysis, and they thought it was demon possession or ancestors who were not having favorable outlook on your future, that kind of mythology. But what we've had recently is the technology, the sleep studies, looking at the brain waves, the airflow associated with the physiology. So the physiology only recently, relatively recently, has become known to us, and now we're bringing the correlates of 3,000 years of other history.
Mm-hmm. Let me read off this list that's listed in this Huffington Post article from today, and perhaps you can comment on one or another of them. Not enough sleep could increase stroke risk. This is something that on this list that we've learned about in the last year. Getting too much sleep can also hurt. Too little sleep leads to poor eating choices. Sleep deprivation affects the immune system, similarly to stress. Sleep can turn off obesity genes. Skimping on sleep to study could mean worse grades. Two more, sleepy surgeons mean risky procedures. And eight, sleep deprivation ups anxiety.
And if you look at this brilliant junior high student from Regina asked me when I gave a lecture there once, do you need to sleep to live? That's common to all those things you just brought up. And it appears that if you sleep deprive an animal, they will die. And we're not sure why they do. So in a nutshell, there is something restorative about sleep for your thinking, for your health, for your immune system, for your psychological well-being. There is something important, restorative, if you will, about getting that 7 to 9 hours of sleep. There's a bell-shaped curve of that. Most of us need 7 to 9, and it's good to get it on a routine basis, or else a lot of the problems that you've just listed aren't being restored, and it just is what Grandma told you. Get 7 to 9 hours. It's good for your health.
Finally, perhaps we can end this hour, Doctor, by talking about sleep as related to this season. We have a condition called SAD, seasonal affective disorder, a problem that surfaces during these short winter days, short daylight for us. Someone who may be feeling what may have SAD right at this period.
Well, and that's right. There's this thought about seasonal affective disorder. It most particularly affects young women, and they often have a very severe depression that is paradoxically associated with overeating, hyperphagia, and this can be almost suicidal.
And it can surface at this time of year again and again, and perhaps the person doesn't realize years on end go by and you don't realize it has something to do with the light.
Right. And in fact, in New York State, there was a study years ago that thought that maybe up to 25% of the population may have elements of the seasonal affective because of less exposure to total sunlight. And we do know, everybody's heard of the melatonins, and it's something you can use to help you sleep. But it is also intrinsic hormone in the human system. When it gets dark, the melatonin is disinhibited through the brain, through the pineal gland, and it rises and it makes you normally, holistically sleepy. What happens with less sunlight is you are sleepier more of the time, a simple way of looking at it. And again, that reduction in total exposure to light can have effect on excessive sleepiness, excessive eating, and your mood, depression, and that seasonal affective disorder. And then they intertwine in a very complicated fashion. And what we often do to treat this is try to fool the system by extending the bright light with the bright light therapy and have them sit in front of this for about an hour, 45 minutes, 30 minutes, whatever works for them in the early morning hours when it's still dark.
Mm-hmm. And what I try to do, this is the most natural way to counter seasonal affective disorder. When you have a nice bright sunny day, if you can afford to before work, you dash out, if you're like me, with your dog and go for a nice walk in that sunrise.
Yeah, 50,000 lux, something like that, and 5,000 to 10,000 is all that the bright light gives you. Oh, yeah, that's the best.
That's the ultimate, and you are the ultimate in sleep advice, we think. Dr. Dyken, director of the Sleep Disorder Center at the University of Iowa Hospitals and Clinics. We appreciate you coming in every so often to update us on sleep news and research, and we get to have all these great listeners who call in with their questions and their experiences so that we may all learn to have a better night's
Absolutely.
Sleep. And thank you, Dr. Dyken. Can you remind us how people get in touch with your sleep clinic?
Yeah, the sleep center is 319-356-3813, 319-356-3813. We got a lot of great technicians, nurses, engineers, doctors, happy, well-slept people.
Okay, Dr. Dyken, thank you very much. Coming up tomorrow on this program, make sure you tune in. We'll discuss the future of gambling in Iowa, how evolving regulation of online gaming may help or hinder the state's gaming industry. That's tomorrow, gambling in Iowa. River to River is produced by Emily Woodbury and Sarah Bowden. Production assistance today from Caitlin Fry. The executive producer of Iowa Public Radio's talk shows is Catherine Perkins. Theme music written and performed by the River Monks of Des Moines. River to River is a production of Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Thanks for joining us.